Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Kaneko Great Minds Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a conversation between New Yorker magazine critic and journalist Joan Acocella and Timothy Schaffert, web editor of Prairie Schooner and director of the Nebraska Summer Writers Conference at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Miss Acocella is the author of several books, including 28 Artists and Two Saints, a collection of essays about creative people in many fields. She has also written about Willa Cather and on a range of other topics. Her current writing project is on the relationship between dance and madness. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, October 27, 2010, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of Kaneko, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Kaneko Executive Director Hal France.
It's now my pleasure to introduce Timothy Schaffert, who will be conducting tonight's interview with Joan Acocella. Timothy is the web editor of Prairie Schooner, a product of the University of Nebraska-Lincoln's creative writing program. It is one of the oldest and most prestigious literary journals in the nation. He is the director of the Nebraska Summer Writers Conference at UNL and the author of four novels, with a new novel coming in May, The Coffins of Little Hope. We've had the pleasure of working with Timothy on numerous occasions as the venue and partner with the Downtown Omaha Lit Fest, wonderful annual event that happens here and all around town, and we've enjoyed working with him enormously. Please join me in welcoming to the stage Timothy Schaffert.
Thank you so much. Am I on? Am I on? Okay. Can you hear me? Oh, yeah, I guess so. Tonight, we're actually welcoming Joan Acocella back to Nebraska. She's familiar with the place, so hopefully is not too startled and unsettled by these raging prairie winds. But among her previous visits was to give the Geske Lecture at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln in 2001, which was titled Genius and Madness, and was about the choreographer and dancer Nijinsky. She's also spent time in Red Cloud, Nebraska, and those experiences made it into her book, Willa Cather and the Politics of Criticism. Some of Joan's books began as pieces that she wrote for the New Yorker magazine, and that's a magazine that she's been contributing to since 1992. She was appointed dance critic of the magazine in 1998. In addition to writing about the arts, she also writes about the mind, and among her books are Creating Hysteria, Women and Multiple Personality Disorder. She also wrote a critical biography of dancer and choreographer Mark Morris, and she served as editor for the previously mentioned Mad Genius's Diaries of Nijinsky, and also of her mother's memoirs. Her mother was a missionary at a hospital in the 1910s and 1920s in northern Thailand. In her collection of essays, 28 Artists and Two Saints, you could say she brings a psychologist's talent for deduction to her profiles of novelists and performing artists and visual artists, with an understanding of the conflicts inherent in the creative life, and those conflicts being personal, professional, and psychological. In her introduction to the book, she writes about when she first arrived in New York in 1968 and fell in with a group of artists. "There are many brilliant people," she writes. "They are born every day. But those who end up having sustained artistic careers are not necessarily the most gifted. Over time, our group lost many of its members to bad divorces, professional disappointments, cocaine. The ones who survived combined brilliance with more homely virtues, patience, resilience, courage." Please welcome Joan Acocella.
Is it on? It was my grandmother who was the missionary.
Oh, your grandmother, yes.
If my mother had been a missionary in 1910, I would be very old.
It says grandmother right there. We were talking about Dick Cavett earlier, and this feels like the Dick Cavett show, so sophisticated. Yeah, it's Truman Capote and Groucho Marx. That line that I read about this combination of brilliance and more homely virtues, that really sort of serves as a thesis for much of the work in this book and your work overall in this discussion of the artist's life. And so I wanted to read a few questions that you would bring up in an essay about Penelope Fitzgerald, the novelist. Why do we bother to interview artists? Why expect them in 2 hours to tell us their story, or what we're really looking for, a story that will dovetail with the work, explain it? The better the artist, the harder it is to produce such an accounting, for the life has been more fully transformed. Why violate their privacy, brush aside their years of work, the labor of creating stories that are not their story? Mm. Why do we?
Well, I do believe that there's a legitimate way to investigate the lives of artists. I think everyone's interested in how art is created, what creativity is, and actually, literally, how it's done. I mean, I'm interested in how early James Joyce got to the desk in the morning. I'm interested in the fact that he drank white wine continually while he was working. I guess I'm also interested in the relationship between, you said psychological, personal, and I can't remember what else.
Professional.
I'm interested in their moral lives. I'm interested in how much courage they're able to show. I'm interested in the question that they all have to solve for themselves of how much they owe to others and how much they owe to themselves, their work. And I'm interested always with artists, because it's always an issue, in how they deal with failure. My sense, which nobody likes to hear me say, but my sense is that most really good artists have about 10 really good years, which is a sobering, sorry to say this to you, you're an artist. But it's really true. Jackson Pollock had 5 years. And even though he got killed in a car accident, I mean, there are plenty of artists, wonderful artists, who are writers who are one book, one big book guys. Goncharov with Oblomov, Italo Svevo, whom I write about in this book, Confessions of Zeno. He wrote 4 other books, but they're nowhere near as good. These things happen to artists. Or there's a... you can see this every day, and you can see it right now in America. There's a famous... I don't name the living usually, but novelists who've been famous, our great novelists, for 40, 50 years, they get to the age of maybe 70, whatever, they're tired. And also, a lot of artists have really only 2 or 3 points to make. They make it this way. James Joyce said, you'll always write the same book. You're always writing the same book in different ways. But there's a limit to the number of ways you can write that book, you know? And I think I have 2 or 3 things to say. I can say them a little differently depending on who I'm writing about. But I've got, I have a few things that I'm really interested in.
Well, Emile Zola said that that writers describe their own death over and over.
describe their own death. That's kind of wonderful. What do you think he meant?
I guess that sort of concept of imagining a life, I guess, or imagining mm-hmm. a demise. I mean, certainly Zola was illustrating all kinds of possible ends, I suppose, for his characters. But, that sense of writing towards fulfillment, really, and writing towards the uncertainty and bringing a kind of order to chaos, maybe?
Yes, well, of course, that's what they all do, is bring kind of order to chaos, I think. And that's their thought. that form that they bring contains their thought. So that when Saul Bellow writes The Adventures of Augie March and brings in all this material about Chicago and everything about Chicago, it's part of his democratic feelings. It's part of his feeling about being in America and about home and about the struggles of immigrants and Jews. And that's what all that gathering in is. These old people with their trunks with ostrich feathers and stuff like that. So that's, I think, what artistic form is. I don't know what the meaning of this is, but I could probably, if I spent about 10 years here, the business of cutting out and letting air come through and the geometricals, I could figure out something. Well, that's what I'm paid to do, is to figure out what they meant.
Well, to go back a second to this concept of the artist having a good 10 years. You mentioned that in your piece on Martha Graham in the book, in that, but you specified that she had 20 good years.
Yes. A lucky artist and people with a lot to say, and Graham is one, have more good years, but also if they enter into a new period, if they find a new stage, and new interests. And in her case, she went from a kind of primitivism and from an all-female company, which was very important to her, she started using men. Oh. And the work became more narrative, and she was in love. She was in love with Eric Hawkins, her lead man, and the first man she let into her company. And so she entered into a new style. Picasso did that. I mean, these artists actually are statistically freaks. But as I said, if they enter into a new period, Balanchine, maybe Stravinsky, although a lot of people feel that his later work, forget it, but he did enter into a new period, 12 tone. Tolstoy. These are people, I'm only talking about people who lived for a long time, because you can't really weigh that if the person, Michelangelo went through phases in which he seemed to recreate himself every time.
What about this notion of creativity and age? Is there a time when people are more creative? Are there particular arts that are more conducive to youth as opposed to older age?
I don't know. Certainly dancing. but of course, it varies widely from artist to artist. But I will say one thing, which is that youth is very much overrated. I find that young writers are remarkably fettered, held in, by their desire to do something that would be both original and acceptable. But also, very often, young writers are very jealous. They're very worry. They very much think, why did he get the National Book Award and I didn't? So, for example, if you look at, I'm thinking of Saul Bellow again, if you look at his first two books, they're very much in the vein of famous earlier books by other people. It wasn't until he really broke the mold and took a chance with Augie March that he became Saul Bellow. A lot of young artists are very conservative, which is the opposite of what we think. But look around you, and it's true. They're trying to do something that'll, be acceptable. As for aging, you just see just an enormous range. I plan to peter out about 72 or something. I'm going to be tired. I'm tired already. And of course, what I said a moment ago about, some of our greatest novelists, well, Saul Bellow, you see a petering out. And they're trying to find, you can see it with your favorite artists, they're trying to find some new train to get on and it doesn't quite work. And all the critics are saying, well, why isn't he, you know, what he was? And, of course, he's trying to be something new because he's tired of what he was or he can't do it anymore. But it is true with some artists that age brings them a new idea. I mentioned Michelangelo. There's such a thing as what is called the late period, where the artist does what he or she used to do, but on a new plane, and which is usually more difficult, if I use the word spiritual, you have to understand I don't necessarily, except for Michelangelo, I don't necessarily mean it in a religious sense, but what I'm saying is the work is less realistic and less easy. So Beethoven entered into a whole new period and one of great difficulty. Michelangelo, so if you know the Rondanini Pietà, and which is, you know, basically lines and sorrow, and compare it to the Vatican Pietà, which I just saw last week, that beautiful, realistic statue that you all know of, that beautiful young Madonna with the Christ over her lap. It's realism, it's classical. That's, you know, he made it, I think, when he was 27 or 28. Who else? Ibsen entered into a period where his great interest in social issues fell away, and he was more interested in memory, desire, what the sky looked like under a certain moon, you know, things like this. Rosmer's Home. Who else? Shakespeare is, of course, the best example. You know, he wrote the so-called late plays, and they are hard to understand. They're much less realistic. The endings are bewildering. People die and then come to life. You know, daughters are lost for 20 years and then found. Those plays are, when I think my mother and father were young, those plays weren't even taught, except maybe The Tempest. But now, I think Winter's Tale, which is, for my money, finest of them, is considered one of the great plays now. Pericles is mostly lost. Cymbeline is now being shown, which nobody liked before because it was just so strange. These plays are strange. This work is strange. But anyway, there is such a thing as a great late period. Huh. It should happen to all of us, right?
We should all have several periods. I'm thinking of John Cheever, the great New Yorker writer whose short story published consecutively in The New Yorker, and then they stopped publishing him when his work got strange, really. And
yes. I think what must it be like for the editors of The New Yorker finally to say, I know that Dorothy Parker, they started turning down her work when she had been, you know, one of the jewels in the crown, you know.
And how do we decide what an artist's great period is? Do we, we don't want them to be too popular because then they're a popular artist, but we don't want them to be too obscure because then it's not accessible on any level. So, like, how do we, is it a collective critical regard that determines an artist's great period? Or
I do. No, of course it's, you know that the opinion of people changes with time, right? I recently, not recently, a couple years ago, worked on an artist, a writer named Stefan Zweig, Austrian artist he died during World War II, but in a double suicide with his wife, very bum, bum, bum. But his period was, his youth was turn of the century Vienna, which, as you know, was an immensely fertile period. Strange time of Freud and Gustav Klimt and Schnitzler and so forth. and of course the musician, composers, but Schoenberg, Berg, and so forth. But Zweig, Stefan Zweig. And by the way, can I see a show of hands how many people have read something by Stefan Zweig? Ah, we have 1, 2, 3, 4 people. Zweig was maybe in the 20s the most popular writer in Europe. His work was, you know, people waited for it, sort of like Stephanie Meyer today or something. I certainly all the time, because I'm a critic, decide who's great and what their great period is. And I say it much to, you know, I'm sure they, you know, I have said of artists, she hasn't, you know, the last great thing she made was in 1983.
And in this age of immediate response, do you find yourself taken to task for your criticism more frequently, do you think?
More frequently than what?
And say 5 years ago or 10 years ago before everything was...
No, so I'm actually a little milder than I used to be. the young are mean. For some reason, no, I don't completely understand. No, I'll tell you, I do understand it. If you succeed in criticism, if you get a decent job and people like you, you're more likely to be allowed to choose what you're going to write about. When you're young, you're fifth string. You have to go see all the stuff that nobody else wants to see. And there's a reason they don't want to see it. So that's what you're writing about. Very often you're writing about mediocre stuff. But I don't write about mediocre stuff anymore because I don't have to. And also, I'm old enough now that I don't want to waste my time. I want to write about things that will truly absorb me. Also, I have to say, I'm sure you've all suspected this, it's much easier to write a negative review than a positive review. Very often, when you're writing negative reviews, you are writing the same review. There are certain things that I don't like more than other things. For example, for me, sentimentality is really tough. It's really hard. Whereas for my ex-husband, bring it on, you know, who was also a critic. So there are things that all of us find bearable and unbearable. Generally, if I'm writing about something, if it is sentimental, and also if it doesn't have an understandable form, if the form is A, B, C, D, E, F, instead of A, B, A prime, B prime, I'm going to like it a lot less. To me, that's laziness. So that's... was always a problem for me with Pina Bausch's work. It was always a problem for me with a lot of work of the 60s, avant-garde work of the 60s. So, I'm sorry, to get back to my point, when you write negative reviews, very often you dislike the same things. So it's very easy. Also, you can score some good jokes, and, you know. But with an artist whom you actually respect, then it's a much more selfless act. If you really respect the artist, then you have to sit there for a while and think of who he or she truly is. I'm not he or she, the work. You have to sit there with the work and say, what is this? And also you're going to assume that there's a big thing, not a small thing. So it's much harder and more interesting to write positive reviews. Unless they're the silly raves that you know, this tango show is pow from the beginning. You know, and I mean, I could write that very easily, and many people write it very easily. But anyway, good reviews are harder to write. I don't know what the question was. I'm sorry, I got away from it.
I forgot.
But I'm sorry. As I do remember one thing, which is as time passes, you're given more freedom as to what, even on a daily newspaper. At the New York Times, the lead critic in large measure decides what he's going to write about, and the three stringers do the rest. And that's just it.
Going back to creativity, can it be taught?
Yes, I think so. You know, there's a big mystique in talking about the arts about what can't be taught. I remember, one thing that is constantly said of dance is that you can't teach musicality. Musicality is the ability, the dancer's ability to play with the music, understand the music so well that she can have a musical response to the music, a varied response to the music. She can live within the music, instead of just going on the beat. All right, so they always say you can't teach musicality, which is like, you know, makes it sound so mystical. But I was talking once to, I guess she was maybe the most musical dancer of my time in America, Suzanne Farrell, and I said, is it true you can't teach musicality? She said, I teach it every day. You know, I give them threes over sevens. I give them, you know, fours over nines or something like this. She teaches musicality insofar as she can. Now, you're a creative writing teacher. You answer the question. Don't you think at least that you can free them?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah. I mean, you can direct them. I mean, there's going to be some people who come into the class whose all their creative energy goes into the way they dress and the way they wear their hair. And then other people who might be a chemistry major who doesn't think they're creative at all but is writing really profoundly interesting stuff. And so it's somewhat a matter of perspective, maybe?
Yeah. I just would try, I think, to I talk to young critics all the time. I get dragged in front of everybody's classroom, which I enjoy because I miss teaching. I don't teach anymore because it's too hard to teach and write at the same time. You've done it, but I find that teaching is very hard. One thing I would try to talk about with young artists and critics is how to balance tradition with creativity. This term creativity is understood in our time to mean making a certain kind of work. It's not just work, it's a certain kind of work, which is work that is assumed to be to come from within and to be original and emotional and freed, as opposed to, we didn't have this idea, you know, until it was there before, but it wasn't until the 19th century that this became the predominant view of art. In the 18th century, people felt that art was a job. No matter how much respect they had for themselves, they felt that if they followed in the footsteps of Aristotle or, you know, Alexander Pope, they were doing a good job at their job, which was poetry. And they felt that it came from without. It came from outside themselves through examples and subject matter and blah, blah, blah. We, in the 20th century, in the 19th, believe that art comes from within. And very often through some kind of magical process, inspiration, something like this, the muse. I don't mean to make fun of this because I am making fun of it, I'm sorry, but it's crippled a lot of artists. They're too worried about being original. I think that some of the very best artists, you know, go through a very conservative early period. Stravinsky did. I mean, basically what he did was copy his teacher, Rimsky-Korsakov. Picasso, if you've ever seen the very early paintings, I mean, they're just masterpieces of realism. His father was a painter. I think he probably copied his father. And Velázquez, and so. But I mean, he gave himself a course in painting. George Balanchine, well, no, that doesn't work. He started out a little wild. But a lot of very fine artists start out, as I said, conservative. A lot of very original ones. I would try to talk to them about how you shouldn't be afraid of using models.
Models?
Models. Mm. You shouldn't worry constantly that your work is going to sound too much. I mean, if you want it to sound like Philip Roth, let do it for a little while, you know? Young artists are always so worried. And they don't have any money, and you know, their girlfriend left them. And
So I was talking about this concept of the artist's life, basically, and what you do in your essays is indicate that it's not this sort of arc. It's this, you know, that there's the way that life influences the art, but then there's the way that the art influences the artist and influences the life. And what you so you have these great, actually, kind of magical, mythological moments you describe, like there's this great moment with Suzanne Farrell where she has to learn the dance in the pregnant ballerina's apartment, and she's and there's no music and they're hand clapping so that she can learn the beats and all of this. And then you describe in one of the most riveting essays Martha Graham's legacy being sort of wrapped up in copyright and litigation and all of that, and how that sort of affects ultimately how her work endures. And so there are these, you bring this kind of clear eye to, without necessarily demythologizing, you're looking at, this is how it works.
I'm interested in the way they really live. I really don't mean their love lives. Their love lives are very important, but I don't just mean that. I mean money, lawsuits, publicity. My training for all of this was the book that Timothy mentioned, my biography of Mark Morris. That was a book-length thing, and so I gave myself the job of tracking this man and trying to understand how he produced steps that said something about it to us about our lives. He's an artist who, even though he's an abstract choreographer, people feel, which I think they like to very much, that it's about their lives, that they can find some path into it. Truly abstract art, well, truly abstract art doesn't really exist. People don't love it because they can't find an entry. They want to hear something about their lives, by which I don't mean, you know, it always has to have a story. But anyway, so I tracked this man for 2.5 years. I didn't do that alone. I was reviewing from week to week, month to month. But he was my training, because I knew what his love life was like. I knew when he broke his foot, and that he was so young when he broke his foot. He was a very great dancer. It's a little hard to go on being a great dancer once you've broken your foot, even if it heals. I knew what it was like in his high school to be not just gay, but very effeminate. In the 1960s, money situations, feelings about social class, all of these things, his position in his family, which is quite the relationship between him and his mother. He had one of those mothers who took one look at that child and said, that's the one I was waiting for. And from then on, she just stood there with the car keys waiting to take him where he wanted to go. Well, it was, you know, to this day, she's gone now. She died last year. But Maxine Morris, I mean, still in his programs, if you look at the bottom in every program, it says, thanks to Maxine Morris. It used to say, thanks to Maxine Morris and God. But I think he decided she was God. I'm not sure that Mark Morris's siblings appreciated this situation. But there it is. And he was one of those children who was a brilliant child. And so it was hard for her not to fall in love with him. But in any case, artists' lives are made out of a lot of circumstances. You know, I remember, you know, psychoanalytic studies of artists are always like, oh, you know, the primal scene, or oh, he was the neglected child, or oh, he felt guilty because his siblings didn't get the attention he got, or things like that. It's not always that. And it's certainly not necessarily their love lives. I don't think artists have wonderful love lives. They're too busy working. And also, correct me if I'm wrong, they very often, the artists who achieve the most have very often neglected their families terribly. One of the problems with getting any work done these days is we don't have what are called literary wives anymore. There used to be a thing called a literary wife. And she read your galleys. Willie Cather had a literary wife, Edith Lewis, who read the galleys, bought the opera tickets, kept the importunate guests away, did everything. Literary wives, and, you know, some people still have literary wives. She does not have a job. She raises the kids and shushes them if the great man is working. I discuss literary wives I discuss that in the James Joyce piece. James Joyce had a wife who wanted no part of being a literary wife. It was really marvelous. She thought, "Ech, what do I?" I don't think she read Ulysses. What affects the work are many, many things, and one thing I was always very concerned about, is it because I was so concerned about women artists? I don't know. Maybe because, not because of Mark Morris, he really didn't have that many failures. I was very concerned with Willa Cather, who was an artist who really, in many ways, had it tough. In the 1920s, she was the most popular novelist in the United States. But she was treated like dirt by the critics. That was a time of experimentalism in the most advanced art. And so this is the time of Hemingway and Fitzgerald and those folks. Dorothy Parker, all these, you know, sort of gin and fast cars and sex. She was a very conservative person in her social life, in her politics, and in her subject matter. You don't hear a lot about the sex lives of Willa Cather's people. So I was very concerned with failure. I don't mean the life as a failure. I mean failures that they had to face. And Cather faced failures. She had, there's one book, for example, I think in 1918 maybe, a book called One of Ours, which the first half of which takes place in Nebraska, and the second half takes place in Europe, where the hero is fighting in the First World War. So I set so much stock on this book. She was so proud to be writing about the war and to have this male hero, not for the first time, but there was really concentration. She set so much store by this work and was very proud of it. And she, in fact, won the Pulitzer Prize for it. But the only people who liked it were the cornballs, you know, the fuddy-duddies. Everybody else, including critics who had been kind to her before and who had liked My Antonia and, you know, O Pioneers, everybody just dumped on that book unbelievably. It was a terrible moment for her, and it really, in my opinion, changed her life. Changed her work, in a good way, in a good way. But I think that when that book failed, Cather, she had a period of great unhappiness, but I think she understood, because of the nature of this book and why it had failed, largely, there was a strong element of insincerity in it. She set up a situation, and I think this is true of My Antonia too, but she was too young to realize it then. She set up a situation which was actually tragic, and then at the end she tried to cover it over because she was afraid that it was tragic. She was afraid that life was tragic. And once one of ours failed, she wasn't afraid anymore that life was tragic. And she wrote her very great books, A Lost Lady, Professor's House, and Death Comes for the Archbishop. She sort of faced something about life. But this is, I don't mean to talk about Cather, although she, with Mark Morris, was one of my great, great loves. But to talk about failure, which is something that I think all of us, unless we're tremendously lucky, have had in our lives. A child that we thought was going to do great things, and he doesn't. A marriage that fails, a career that fails, a book that fails. And how a person responds to failure is, because a long career, Cather wrote from 1913 or something to the late 1950s. It's a very long career. Not to speak, Balanchine's career was, I think, 72 years long. No, that can't be. He died at 79. But very long. Stravinsky, these are huge, long careers. Tolstoy. There has to be failure in those in those periods. So they have to be able to withstand and explain something to themselves and in the case of Cather, although I don't think this is necessary, to grow. You know, what doesn't kill you makes you strong. I mean, that happened with Cather, with one of ours. It taught her something, but it really broke her heart. And also, I've always been very concerned not exclusively concerned, but I have been concerned with the lives of women artists because they just were more discourageable. If they had a failure, they were more likely to give up. And I don't think that's anything about women. I think it's the way women have been raised and trained. It's just too easy for women to say when they have a failure, oh, I shouldn't have been writing books anyway. I should have gotten married. I should have married the orthopedist. done what my parents wanted me to do.
In a few minutes, we'll take some questions. And while they're setting up, I have another. I, just to go off that a little bit more about women and creativity and in the arts. I found, you know, on Facebook little things pop up, and this has been going around about the Paris Review interviews and the disparity between women writers interviewed for the magazine over the years versus men, and ultimately of the 335 total interviews between 1950 and 2010, there were 61 women and 274 men.
60 women and 274 men. Mm. Well, look, I mean, actually, that's pretty good. Well, look at the major symphony orchestras in the United States. How many of them are led by women? One, Baltimore. What's her name? Maren Alsop. And, you know, the community was furious at her being brought. No, I mean, face facts. There's only, I think, one field in which women can be said to have consistently equaled or gone beyond men, and that is the novel, your field. When I say field, I mean field of art. There are plenty of other fields in the world where women excel. But, yeah, I mean, you know, look, for years they weren't educated. A very instructive book about this is Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own. It's only, go out and get it. It's about 75 pages long. But she says, well, what would have happened to Shakespeare's sister? Would it have been okay for her to go by herself to London? Would they have accepted, if she was an actress there, that she write a play for them? My father paid for my brother's graduate school. He didn't pay for my graduate school. My father would have wanted me to marry the orthopedist. Truly, I'm not kidding. As I said, that shows that Paris Review is actually paying attention to women.
Well, and Cather herself, you know, you visit Red Cloud and you can see her commencement speech where she's already complaining about...
Oh, yeah, but the thing is, she had very great reason to complain. And then for, you know, practically her whole life, she was treated like great books or you know, she was treated like, the corny thing that your grandmother would like. Do you know what I mean? She was, in many ways, the most experimental, hardworking. You know, while all those cool cats were out, you know, having sex and drinking and stuff like this, she was home working. And, you know, that's another thing about artists, if they know, whether they know how to work. As the expression, I'm going to pronounce it wrong, Sitzfleisch. It means your ability to stay in your seat. And it's how much sitting flesh you have. It's an important. There's a book. Can I? Should I? All right. There's a book by a woman at Johns Hopkins named Kay Jameson, and she's a big expert on manic depressive illness. And she's sort of written the book on manic depressive illness, a very scientific book. And then she wrote a book claiming that manic depressive illness was related to creativity, that there was something... Now, how many of you would suspect that Kay Jameson has manic depressive illness? She confessed that later. But I think she thinks, it's a source of her creativity. But she wrote a book claiming that all the most important... No, a disproportionate number of the English writing poets of the 19th and 20th century all had manic depressive illness. Now, there are many problems with this argument that we won't go into, but one problem that she doesn't take into account is that in manic depressive illness, during the manic periods, the person can work for 12 hours at a sitting. Sitting at your desk is really a lot the ability to like sit at your desk and not go play tennis or pet your dog or something like that. I mean, I tell you, you know, in my life I've worked very hard. And that was part of it. You know, you just sit there until the work is done. And I mean, there's one person who's very important in ballet history, Lincoln Kirstein. And he would work 12 hours at a stretch. This man got so much done, you simply can't believe it. But in any case, Kay Jameson mentions in a footnote, well, they do spend more hours at the desk. And I thought to myself, how could this be a minor fact? You know, the ones who really achieve things are working for many hours every day. Some artists, like, you know, I don't know, maybe Rambo or something like this, you know, walk into their room and go like this and walk out. But Gertrude Stein. Most of them are really sort of boring folks who just, you know, drudges.
Well, that's what I always tell my students. The major difference between a published novelist and an unpublished one is that the published one finished the book.
Very true.
Are we ready for questions?
David Sedaris was in Omaha this week, and I heard him. And one thing that he said I thought was, I'd never heard a writer myself say this, that when he writes, as you said, you're interested in how the work is done. He gets up in the morning and he spends three and a half hours at his desk working, and then he does whatever he does. And then when he goes back to it in the afternoon, he reads aloud to see how the work sounds being read. And I thought that was so interesting, and I liked the way that sounded to me. I'm not a writer. But I wonder if that ever happens to either one of you, if you know of that being something that novelists do.
No, I have never heard anyone say that before, although I'll bet that some of these literary wives have heard a lot of readings.
True.
But it's very important what you're saying, because speaking of things that may not be able to be taught, an ear. Of course, writers and readers have a mental ear. They can hear. Philip Roth has one of the greatest ears in American fiction. I think the greatest ear in American fiction was Willa Cather's. There's no unshapely sentence. There's no sentence that doesn't have a song in it. And that's a good part of writing. Sometimes I think that it's conferred unfairly. That it's one of those things, like the ability to be funny, that, you know, Mother Nature gives you, or something like this. But what he's doing is very wise. And that's one of the reasons that Sedaris's work, which I was just reading last week, flows so wonderfully. It's so easy to love, you know? What you surprised me with was that he goes back to it in the afternoon.
That's what he said.
Yeah, my guess is he's correcting. It's a very common pattern for good artists. I said they work for 12 hours, but it's a very common pattern to wake up, do 3.5 hours, the 3.5 hours you're talking about, have lunch, and then for the rest of the day, answer correspondence, read galleys. You know, there's a tremendous amount of clerical and business work having to do with being a writer. And I'm sure it's true of a painter. You know, they have to clean their brushes or something. I don't know. But one thing that I've always done wrong is that I do the administrative work when I get up. And Alice Munro, this wonderful Canadian short story writer, said that she gets out of her bed and walks straight to the desk. She writes in her nightgown, and her husband brings her a cup of coffee.
Literary man.
Literary husband.
Can I make one more comment? But you know, I don't know how many years ago, but 100 years ago, people did read aloud to the family.
Absolutely.
And I thought that's what that reminded me of.
Well,
shouldn't things be read aloud?
Nobody gets read to anymore except children. In the old days, you know, there was no TV.
You both talked about this idea of whether creativity can be taught, and I have small children, so I'm interested in that question. And for me, creativity is a lot about being more aware and sort of capturing the little bits of flotsam that kind of pass by on the stream, and playing that back in new and original ways. And I'm wondering, you know, whether what your thoughts are on that, Joan, and Tim, whether that's part of how you teach creativity.
Well, you teach it, so why don't you take the question?
What now?
this
whole idea of why distraction is so destructive to creativity is because it interrupts our awareness, our perceptiveness of all the junk that's in our minds. And the great creatives are able to capture these little bits of flotsam and play them back in new ways.
Yeah.
And so can we teach creativity by teaching
observation,
yeah. Curiosity.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'm constantly eavesdropping on conversations and stealing little bits of people's characters and sort of filing it away in my head. I always have notebooks, but I always forget to carry them around with me. And so it's, but I think that's good because then the stuff that doesn't matter just does kind of fall away. But then stuff will attach itself to other stuff, and then a character will emerge. And I think, I think that is the thing that engages you as a writer or an artist, I presume, of being able to notice the shapes of things and the landscape and to notice it and to describe it in your head and to figure out how it might work with your imagination.
I would think for a novelist, this would be that what you're talking about would be the most. That's the art for which that kind of attention would be. The most important, but what's interesting about your question is, you know, one of the things we want in fiction is a sense of the texture of reality, which is never smooth. And if you pay attention to things, you'll see reality is never smooth, you know? And that's what makes things less cliched, is if actually contraries are there together, you know?
Thank all of you so much for coming tonight, and thank you, Joan. I'm so sad we're finished.
we could have gone on all night. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Kaneko Great Minds Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a conversation between New Yorker magazine critic and journalist Joan Acocella and Timothy Shaffert, web editor of Prairie Schooner and director of the Nebraska Summer Writers Conference at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Miss Acocella is the author of several books, including 28 Artists and Two Saints, a collection of essays about creative people in many fields. She's also written about Willa Cather and on a range of other topics. Her current writing project is on the relationship between dance and madness. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, October 27, 2010, for broadcast at this time. The next event in the Kaneko Great Minds series will be Friday evening, January 14th at 7:30 at the Kaneko Beau Truss, 11th and Jones. The guest speaker will be Greg Mortensen, author of Three Cups of Tea and Stones into Schools. His topic will be Promoting Peace Through Education. Special thanks to Heike Langdon, Kaneko Events and Community Relations Manager, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Special thanks also to Kaneko Sound Engineer Rick Weiner and KIOS-FM Recording Engineer Mike Hansen for their assistance in the recording of this program. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, and podcasts of selected Noon Forum programs are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.